17. The Four Aces Motel was a series of square stucco cabins, modern in appearance, Californian in style, well located at the edge of the highway, entering San Francisco from the south. The neon sign was immense. The interior of each cabin was a dim chamber, and in the center of the chamber was the shower. After the paying guest had set down his suitcases and closed the door against the fatigue and glare of the drive, he looked about and saw the bed, clean, wide, and the lamp, brass and slender and amazingly tall. And then he saw the shower. And the guest stripped off his sweaty clothes, his slacks and shorts and sport shirt and shoes, and went happily into the shower. Under his bare toes, the floor was a rough and sensuous porous stone, similar to limestone, but sprayed a pastel blue-gray. The walls, also porous and stone-like, were green. The shower was a part of the room, not an annex. A foot-high rampart of adobe blocks retained the water. The blocks were irregular, like the foundation of a ruined Spanish fort, and the guest felt as if he, or she, were standing in the center of some ancient, secure, unchanging structure, in which he or she was free to do what he liked, be what he wished. Beneath the shower of Cabin C, Patricia Gray stood with her legs apart as she reached to scrub her ankles. The door of the cabin was partly open, and the late afternoon sunlight poured in through the slot. And in the sunlight, the image of gravel, a field of gravel, spreading to the square of lawn and deck chairs and beach umbrellas in the shade behind the neon sign. And then El Camino itself, the trucks, and the San Francisco commuter traffic went nose to tail, and the noise was a deep, ceaseless drumming. Now they were leaving the city. Now, at this moment, at the end of the day, the traffic moved south. Over the bed, a plastic Emerson radio played a dance record. On the bed, Art lay spread out in his slacks and shirt, reading a magazine. "Do me a favor," Patricia said.
"A towel?"
"No," she said. "Turn off the radio, would you? Or get something else." The jukebox tunes reminded her of the station, her job, and Jim Briskin. Art made no move to get up. "Come on," she said. He did not stir, so she took the immaculate white bath towel supplied by the motel and padded across the room. Drizzling water from her hair and head and body, she clicked the switch of the radio. "Okay," she said. She was afraid enough of him to remain close to the radio as she dried herself. The silence seemed to oppress him. "Get something on it," he said. She said, "I don't want anything from the outside." This must be complete, she thought, if it is going to have any chance at all. From the clothes that she had bought him, she picked up a red and gray sports shirt. He had worn it once on the drive from San Francisco. Holding it, she went to the bed and said, "Can I wear this?" Glancing up, he saw her and the shirt. "Why?" "I just want to," she said. "It's too big." But she put on his shirt. The bottom of it trailed across her thighs. From one of her suitcases, she took a pair of jeans and put them on. She unfastened her hair and began to comb it. In the jeans and sport shirt, she padded about the room. She carried bottles and jars and tubes and packages to the medicine cabinet in the bathroom, and to the top of the dresser. The closet was already full of her clothes. She did not unpack the rest. There was no room. "You sure have a lot of stuff," Art said. "No," she said, "not so much."
"All those bottles."
She went into the tiny kitchen to see if there was cupboard space. They had brought no cooking utensils. On the drain board was a package of cookies and four navel oranges and a carton of milk and a loaf of Langendorf bread and a jar of cheese bread and by itself a fifth of Gallo port. She opened the wine and, rinsing out the tumbler supplied by the motel, poured herself a glass. Through the back window of the motel, she saw a yard of planks and uncompleted concrete foundations. On a clothesline, trousers and work shirts hung. A desolate scene, she thought. Returning to the living room, she said, "This is nice here." At the front door, she stood watching the trucks go by. The time was 7 o'clock, and the sun was beginning to set. The flow of traffic had dwindled. They were already home, she thought, the commuters in their business suits and neckties. "When did you want to eat?" she said.
"I don't care."
"There's a coffee shop up the road," she said. "You want to go there?" He tossed aside the magazine.
"Sure."
As they walked along the shoulder of the highway, she said,
"What's wrong?"
"I don't know." "Do you want to drive on? Stop somewhere else? We could drive all night if you want."
"You got your stuff unpacked."
"I can repack it," she said. The door of the coffee shop was propped open. It was a wide, modern coffee shop, with a counter at one side and booths at the other. Cars were pulled up in the gravel lot beside it. Most of the people were from the motel, middle-aged men and women on their vacations. She thought, from the East, from Ohio, coming out here to California for a week, in their Oldsmobiles. At the counter, Art spun a stool and seated himself. He picked up the menu and examined it.
"I'm hungry," she said. "I have an appetite. You know what I'd like to do? Let's ask them if they can fix the food to take out, so we can take it back with us."
"What?" he murmured.
"To our cabin, and eat it there."
The waitress was before them. "Are you ready to order?" she said, swabbing the counter with a white cloth.
Pat said, "Can you fix food to go?"
Speaking in the direction of the cook, the waitress said,
"Can we fix food to go?"
"Depends on what they want," the cook said, appearing. "Salad, sandwiches, coffee. Not soup."
"What about the dinner?"
Pat said. On the menu, they listed veal chops and green peas and potatoes.
"If you have a plate," the cook said, "but we don't have any kind of cartons."
"We can eat it here," Art said. He ordered two of the dinners. The waitress went off with the order. Pat said,
"How do you feel?"
"Fine," he said.
The food arrived and they ate.
"Is this what you wanted?" she said.
"I mean, all of this. Where we are, what we're doing." He nodded. After they had eaten, they ordered beer. Nobody questioned him. He was served his bottle and glass. The beer was cold. The bottle was white with frost.
"Let's go back to the cabin," Pat said suddenly.
"Why?"
"I don't know. These places, you can sit in them for hours."
All the time, she thought, that she had sat with Jim in a bar and eatery like this at the edge of the highway, drinking beer, listening to the jukebox. Fried prawns and beer, the smell of the ocean, the hot night air of the Russian River. On the way back to the cabin, Art seemed resentful. She could not tell. Now the sun was gone, and the sky was dark. Beside her, he was a dim shape plodding over the gravel. Bugs, perhaps moths, flew in their faces, and Art swiped wildly.
"Do they bother you?" she said.
"You darn right,"
she said. "Let's lock ourselves in. Let's stay inside and not come out."
"Ever?"
"As long as we can. The rest of the night until tomorrow. Let's go to bed early."
They entered the cabin and she closed the door. She bolted it and pulled down each of the window shades. The cabin was air-conditioned, and she turned on the fan. It roared, and the noise gratified her.
"This is what I want," she said.
She felt elated. This was complete. They had everything they needed. Finally, they were self-sufficient. Throwing herself down on the bed, she said,
"Come and lie with me, please."
"And do what?"
"Just lie," she said.
Begrudgingly, he sat down on the edge of the bed.
"No," she said. "Don't just sit. Lie down."
"Why don't you?
Isn't this what we ought to be doing?"
Trying to explain to him what she meant, she said,
"This just involves the two of us lying here like this."
Kicking his shoes off, he put his arms around her. Then he reached up to turn off the lamp above the bed.
"No," she said. "I won't let you turn it off."
"Why not?"
"I want you to see me."
"I know how you look."
"Leave it on," she said.
Arising, he left her. He went over and picked up his magazine and seated himself in a chair.
"You are ashamed," she said. "You really are."
He did not look up.
"I wanted to look at you," she said. "Isn't that all right? Shouldn't I do that? I like the way you look."
She waited, and then she said,
"Could you leave on some light? The light in the bathroom, how about that?"
His magazine under his arm, he went to the bathroom and turned on the lamp by the washbowl. Then he came back, and on his face was the fretful look. He reached past her head for the lamp. When it was off, he returned to the bed. The bed sank under his weight. At first, she saw nothing, and then she was able to make out the texture of his hair, the bridge of his nose, his eyebrows and ears, his shoulders. Lifting her hand, she unbuttoned his shirt. She slipped his shirt from him, and then she raised herself up and clasped her arms around him and pressed her head against his chest. He did not move.
"Take off your clothes," she said. "Please, for my sake."
When he had taken off his clothes, she lay beside him, her arm under his head. But there was no response. She slipped down until her dark hair flowed across his stomach, but still he did not stir. "No," she thought, "not at all."
"This is fine," she said, "just lying here."
"Okay," he said. She kissed him. His body was cold, hard, without spirit. "Can't we just lie here?" She unfastened her shirt, and then she took off her jeans. She lay against him with her mouth at his neck, her eyes shut. She buried her fists in his armpits, and she thought, "Never, never at all." "It's only around 8 o'clock, he said.
"I love you," she said. "Do you understand what I mean? For God's sake."
She dug her nails into his face and made him look at her.
"I want to stay with you. This is exactly what I want, what we have now. This is enough."
He said, "I'm not just going to lie around here."
"What do you want? What do you need?
Let's go somewhere." She held him down. She pressed down his wrists, his loins. She gripped him with her legs. She hugged him until her body ached and her breasts were bruised.
"Where?"
she said at last. He said, "I saw the skating rink up the road. We drove by it."
"No,"
she said. "Come on," he said. With his hands, he lifted her from him. He set her beside him in the bed. Getting to her feet, she began putting her clothes back on.
"What sort of skating?"
"Ice skating."
"You want to go ice skating?" she said.
She went away and put the palms of her hands to her chin. Her fingers covered her eyes.
"I can't believe it, Art."
"Why not?" he demanded. "What's the matter with that?"
"Nothing," she said.
"Don't you want to?"
"No," she said. "I don't feel like it. I'll stay here."
"Don't you know how? I'll teach you." He rose and rapidly dressed. "I'm pretty good. I taught a couple of people." She went into the bathroom and locked the door. "What are you doing in there?" he demanded at the door.
"I don't feel well," she said.
She sat down on the clothes hamper. "You want me to stick around?"
"No, go ahead," she said.
"I'll be back in an hour or so," he said.
How about that?"
"Okay?" She stared down at her hands. Presently, she heard the front door of the cabin shut. Gravel crunched as he crossed the lot to the shoulder of the highway. Opening the bathroom door, she ran through the cabin and out onto the porch. Far off by the highway, his figure moved. He became smaller.
"God damn you," she said.
He went on.
"God damn you, Art," she said.
She shut the door. Putting on her shoes, she ran from the cabin across the gravel to the highway after him. Ahead of her, his figure moved, and then it was swallowed up by the lights of a roadside bar and then a gas station. She slowed down. The neon sign of the skating rink was visible, and she kept her eyes on that. She could not see him, but she saw the sign, and she went toward it. By the skating rink, cars were parked, some of them locked up, some still full of people. Kids, she thought.
Boys in sport coats and slacks. Girls in dresses. A lunch counter was attached to the rink, and the kids were going in there. At the window of the rink, a line of kids waited, and Art was one of them. In front of him was a girl in a checkered shirt and saddle shoes, a red wool sweater over her shoulders. The girl was no more than 15. Behind Art, a soldier, round-faced, gangly, waited with his girl. She stood, away from the light, gasping and getting back her wind. The line became longer. Art reached the window, paid for his admission, and then went on inside. A car full of teenagers pulled up, its exhausts thundering. Boys piled out and ran to the ticket window. Behind them, two girls in jeans and sweaters followed. At the window, they struggled and swarmed and shoved one another. The kids blended together, the jeans and shirts, the faces, the hair. When they had gone inside the rink, she turned and walked back to the cabin of the motel. She bolted the door after her. A roaring filled every part of the cabin, and at first she did not know what it was. She could not tell if it were inside or outside her head. It was outside. It was the air conditioner, she realized. They had left it on. With her drink in her hand, she stood before the mirror and declared with certitude that she would have looked absolutely perfect beside him. Together they would have attracted favorable attention. They would have been an outstanding couple. And then she began to cry. She started to sit down, but her hand struck the arm of the chair. The glass tumbled and the remains of her drink spread in a pool across the rug. She touched the pool with her toe. The rug was wet. The coolness felt nice. God, she thought. Walking into the kitchen, she fixed herself another drink. She turned on the radio over the bed, but she could not get KOIF. The transmitter was too far away. On a San Mateo station, she picked up classical music. She turned the volume up loud as it would go. She brought the wine bottle to the bed. Lying down, she snapped off the light. She lay in darkness, drinking, listening to the music. Outside the cabin, cars and trucks passed along the highway. In the next cabin, laughter and voices shrilled out into the darkness. She listened to that, too. When the voices ceased, she turned her attention to the music. The music suddenly was gone. She sat up. At first, she tuned the dial, wondering what had happened to it. And then she realized that the station had gone off the air. The time was midnight. She made her way to the bathroom, washed her face, and then scrubbed her skin. She pressed her face into the fabric until her face ached. Then she came back out and seated herself by the phone. She dialed the KOIF number, but of course there was no answer. With a shock, she realized what she was doing. Not there, she thought, hanging up the phone. He couldn't possibly be there. Nobody was there. It was after midnight. The station was shut down. Holding the receiver in her lap, she dialed her own number. The phone rang on and on. Not there, she thought. She hung up. Next, she dialed his apartment. Again, there was no answer. Nowhere, she thought. She hung up the phone and went to refill her glass. The wine was almost gone. She poured it all into the glass. Once more, she telephoned. Using the San Francisco phone book, she looked up and dialed the Emanuel's number, the apartment on Fillmore Street. Hello, a voice said. Jim, she said. She began to cry. Tears spilled down her cheeks, onto her knuckles and the phone. Where are you? He said. I'm in a motel, she said. I don't know the name. Jim said, where is it? I don't know. She sat crying, clutching the phone. Is he with you? No. From her pocket, she got out her handkerchief and blew her nose. He went out. Jim said, see if there's a match folder. Look by the phone. She looked. She found a match folder with the name Four Aces Motel on it. Jim, she said, I don't know what to do. Did you find a match folder? No, she said, I don't know. She buried the match folder in the phone book out of sight. I know where I am, but I don't know what to do. He went out ice skating. Can you believe that? Tell me where you are, he said, and I'll come get you. Are you in San Francisco?
No, she said. It's down on El Camino Real.
Near what town?
Redwood City. He's up at an ice skating rink with a lot of kids. What's the matter with me, Jim? How do I get mixed up in this?
Tell me the address.
No, she said, shaking her head.
Tell me, he said. Pat, come on. Tell me where you are.
What am I going to do, she said. He's up there with those kids. All he is a kid. He showed me this place they go, this attic. He came over to the apartment and got me to go to dinner with him. We went out to Chinatown. I didn't want to go, but he got me to. I did everything I could, but good God, what can I do if he's going off an ice skate?
Pat, he said, tell me where you are.
I'm scared of him, she said.
Why?
Holding the handkerchief to her eyes, she said,
I don't want you to come down. How can I get out of here, Jim? I have to get away. This didn't work out. You were right.
Why are you afraid of him?
He hit me, she said, crying.
Are you hurt?
I'm okay. He hit me in the eye, and we went on and on that night until there was nothing left of me. He wore me out, and now he's ice skating. There was this girl ahead of him in the line. She...
I want to come and get you, Jim said.
So, tell me where you are. I can't get you unless I know where you are.
She said,
he's afraid of you, Jim. That's why we're down here. He was afraid you'd show up at the apartment. You're the only one he's afraid of. He isn't even afraid of Rachel.
How is Rachel?
Fine, he said. Is she mad?
Look, he said, tell me where you are.
I'm at the Four Aces Motel.
Okay.
Wait, she said. Jim, listen, I did everything I could. I bought him enough clothes so he looked like a man and not like a kid dressed up for Saturday night. It's my car we came down in. What else could I do? All I wanted to do was just lie here in bed and not do anything. But he wouldn't do that.
I'll see you, he said, and hung up. The phone clicked in her ear. For a time, she held it, and then she put it on the hook.
Christ, she said.
Now it had happened. Now it was over. She went unsteadily to the closet and changed from her jeans and sport shirt to a blouse and bolero and long skirt. He liked her long skirts. Then she began braiding her hair. At 12:30, the cabin door flew open and Art entered.
Hi,
he said.
Hello,
she said.
What you been doing?
He saw the empty wine bottle by the bed.
What did you do, drink the whole bottle?
She said,
I called Jim Briskin.
Yeah?
He came around beside her.
No kidding?
I had to, she said. Why did you go off and leave me? I don't understand how you could.
How long ago did you call him?
I don't know.
What's he doing, coming down?
Yes, she said.
By degrees, his face darkened.
Get your stuff packed. Let's go.
I'm going back, she said.
Oh, yeah?
Standing up, she said,
you sneaky little kid. If he ever gets his hands on you, he'll kill you. So you better run as fast as you can and hide.
What did you call him for?
Ice skating, she said.
What else do you do?
Why don't you go out and get me an ice cream soda?
He shuffled his feet and stuck his hands away into his back pockets.
Did you have fun? She said.
Did you meet any kid you knew?
No,
he said.
Why'd you leave?
They closed.
Did you walk some girl home?
Or what did you do, buy a hot dog and a malt?
She felt cold and terrified. She did not dare stop.
Art said, I tried out this guy's MG.
Then you go drive his MG, she said. You just drive it as long as you want.
Are you really going back? He said in a plaintive voice. We just left.
Blame yourself, she said.
Fooling with his belt, he said,
I couldn't see sitting around.
With me, she said. You couldn't see sitting around with me.
There's nothing to do, he said.
From the closet, she got her suitcases.
Will you help me pack?
She began putting skirts and sweaters and blouses into the suitcase.
Come on, Art. Don't make me do all the work.
Going to her purse, he began rooting. "What do you want?" She walked over and took the purse from him.
"The car keys," he said, not looking directly at her.
"Why?"
"I can't hang around here."
"You can't take my car. If you want to leave, go ahead. Go catch a bus or something."
In an instant, he had yanked the purse from her hands. Holding it over the bed, he dumped out the contents.
"I'll leave it off someplace," he said. "You'll get it back."
She said, "If you take my car, I'll call the police and tell them you stole it."
"You will?
It's my car."
She held out her hand.
"Give me back the keys."
"Can't I use it?"
"No," she said.
"Suppose I just take it up to San Francisco and leave it off. I don't want to run into Jim Briskin. He's probably sore as hell."
"He'll kill you," she said.
"Did he say so?"
"Yes," she said.
"It was your idea."
She put her hand up to her eye.
"See what you did to me?"
After a long, uncertain pause, he said,
"You got a couple of bucks I can have? I mean, if I have to get a bus or something?"
"Did you spend everything you had?"
"I paid for some gas," he said, "for this guy's MG.
From the contents of her purse, she took her wallet.
"I'll pay you back," he said.
She gave him $6 or $7, and he put the bills away in his coat.
"You better leave," she said, "before he gets here."
She led him by the arm. His body responded sluggishly, and at the door he hung back, dragging, unwilling to go.
"I'm not leaving," he said. "I don't believe you called Jim Briskin. That's a lot of hot air."
Tugging away from her, he walked back and stopped by the kitchen door, his shoulders hunched.
"Suit yourself," she said.
She continued packing. She collected the bottles and jars and packages and fitted them into the suitcases.
"Is he really coming?" Art said.
"Yes,"
she said.
"You're going back with him?"
"Yes," she said. "I hope so."
"Are you going to marry him?"
"Yes," she said.
His chin sank down. His body hunched until he looked like a little old man, a gnarled old gnomish fellow, nearsighted, hard of hearing. He strained to hear her, to gather his faculties. The youthfulness was gone, the purity.
"What's so good about him?" he said.
"He's a very fine person."
"And you're a skinny old bag."
Lifting the suitcase from the bed, she carried it to the door and set it down. That was one of them, and she began on a second. But it did not seem worth it. She sat down on the bed.
"Just an old bag," Art said. "Why don't you get a cat or a parrot or one of those birds the old maids have, so you can have something to mother?"
"Art," she said, "would you go outside and leave me alone? Please, leave me alone."
"You're not a girl at all," he said. "You're dried up. You're all worn out."
"Stop it," she said.
"Tough,"
he said, immobile. She got up and went outside, onto the porch of the cabin. Headlights of cars flashed by. She walked toward the highway, closer and closer, until under her feet the gravel was gone, and she had come onto the pavement. A car honked. Behind it, a second car slowed and swerved. The distorted features of the driver were visible. And then the car vanished. Its taillight glowed red. The taillight became smaller, and then, at last, it was gone. After a while, a car left the highway and bumped across the shoulder. Its headlights fastened on her, and she was blinded. The car grew, and she put up her hands. She smelled the hot engine as the hood of the car passed in front of her. The door opened. The car stopped rolling.
"Is that you, Pat?"
Jim Briskin's voice came.
"Yes," she said.
She lifted her head. Inside his car, behind the wheel, he sat with the door open, peering at her. When he had recognized her, he got out.
"How are you?" he said,
as they walked toward Cabin C. He patted her on the back.
"I'm pretty good," she said.
"You look run down."
Halting her, he scrutinized her. "He really hit you, didn't he?"
"Yes,"
she said. Ahead of her, he stepped up and into the cabin.
"Hello, Art," he said.
"Hi,"
Art said, flushed and nervous. Jim said, "What did you do, hit her in the eye?"
"Yeah," Art said, "but she's okay."
Turning to Pat, he said, "Let's have your car key."
He looked all around the room as she got the keys from the heap of things on the bed.
"Thanks," he said.
He seemed preoccupied.
"Here, Art."
He tossed the keys to the boy.
"What's this?" Art said.
The keys fell to the floor, and he stooped to pick them up. The key slipped away from him, and he stooped again.
"Your stuff isn't packed, is it?" Jim said to her. "I see it all around."
"No," she said. "I have one suitcase packed."
Going over to Art, he said, "You finish packing your stuff. Put it in the Dodge, and then come on up."
"Up where?" Art said.
"Leave the car in front of her place."
He led Pat from the cabin.
"You want me to unpack it?"
Art said, following after them to the door.
When I get it up there?"
"No," Jim said. "Leave everything in the car."
"What about the keys?"
"Put them in the mailbox."
Holding Pat by the hand, he took her to his car.
As they drove out onto the highway, she said,
"Will he do it?"
"Do you care?" Jim said.
She said, "Thanks for coming."
"I think that ends it."
Behind them, the Four Aces Motel was already lost among the neon signs.
"How are you otherwise?"
"I'll live," she said.
"It was certainly hard getting the name out of you, the motel name." After that, neither of them said anything. They watched the road, the cars and signs, the headlights that flashed by. Leaning back against the seat, Pat slept a little. When she woke up, they were on the freeway. To the right was the bay. Now there were fewer lights.
"That dirty little squirt of a kid," she said.
"Okay," he said.
"He socked me right in the eye. He knocked me out."
"Now you have something to talk about," he said. "Something you can point to."
"And he pulled a knife on Bob Posen."
Jim said, "Who cares?"
She shrank away. She found her handkerchief in her pocket and began to cry into it. Her head turned away from him. She cried as quietly as possible.
"Don't listen to me," he said.
"No," she said. "You're right."
He reached over and caressed her arm.
"Why don't you shut up? Nobody feels sorry for you. When we get into town, we'll stop and buy something for your eye."
"I don't want anything," she said. "You know what he called me? He called me a lot of terrible things. I haven't heard words like that since I was a child. And he wanted me to borrow on my car. He wanted..."
Again she was crying. She could not help it. She cried on and on, and Jim Briskin paid no attention. The freeway joined with other freeways leading into San Francisco. In due time, they were driving above houses. Most of the houses were dark. Their lights were off.